surpass penetrating and perfect dharma is rarely met with even 100,000 million kalpas. Having to see enters into to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
See you here to be present with maybe we can all I'll say some complicated words today, you know, about the Heart Sutra. Maybe introduce you a little bit to Yogacara thinking, which I'll explain in a minute. But really, we're just practicing fading into emptiness. I hope you get a little taste of that at some point today, where the mind can clear and that relief on the out-breath, just you disappearing a little bit. How refreshing that can be. So these words just encourage you to do something pretty simple, which is just pay attention to your breath and your body and let go. You know, let go of all the way your mind works and wants to contract and define and categorize things and just fade a little into emptiness. So, I need my glasses. Are those my glasses up there, or are those your glasses? They could be mine. Thank you. Thank you so much, Dale. Sometimes I forget my Dharma talks, you know. It's always like I open it up and I realize, oh, I don't have my Dharma talk, you know. So then I have to figure out what's going to happen, but I have something here. So I think the most difficult thing in practice for me, and if you're honest, probably for you, is to really have some sense that you really do have tremendous power over controlling your universe. And how strong our conditioning is to think that the universe, the phenomenal world, controls us. So a lot of what practice is to try to give you some tools and some confidence that, in fact, you actually have an enormous amount of ability and power in how you create your universe. So maybe all Dharma talks have addressed this topic. So I've been studying people in my group. We've been studying the Heart Sutra. And the Heart Sutra tries to address that, you know. And I've been reading and kind of paying attention to this one phrase in the Heart Sutra that says, what page is it originally, Chris? Where it is, Heart. Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase or decrease. So that is so radical. That's so incredibly radical. The dharmas are neither defiled or pure. So what that is saying is that in some level, there is no good and bad are inextricably intertwined. And that was a very radical departure from the way Buddhism had been practiced. Before, the way it had been practiced was a little closer to the way most religions are practiced, which is that we actually have these dharmas, which are kind of what we call wholesome dharmas and unwholesome. Dharmas, by the way, are not only what you think, all the thoughts that you have, different kinds of thoughts, but are also a phenomenal world out there, like this can be a dharma, this is a dharma, this body is a dharma, everything can be a dharma. They're kind of divided up into what were wholesome dharmas and unwholesome dharmas. And what the Heart Sutra is saying is, yeah, you're spending too much time dividing these things up between states of mind that are good and not good. And what you have to really understand is that even these unwholesome states of mind, these anger states of mind and these contracted states of mind and jealousy states of mind and restless states of mind, you know, or things out there, you know, are actually, they need each other to exist. And that's such a relief, you know, because then we can let go in terms of like trying to spend so much time of our energy dividing things up. But then I, in the studying the Dharma and really paying attention to that one phrase, which to me is a very powerful phrase in the Heart Sutra, I started to come across, not just started, I, you know, on the peripheral of my interest has always been the study of the Yogacara. And then this book recently came by Ben Conley. I met him down in Tassara a couple weeks ago. He's in our tradition, a Zen tradition. And so I started to bring it a little closer, and some articles came to me, and I started to read it. I realized, oh, this is wonderful. I really like this. It was always so complicated before, and I couldn't really approach it. I always liked the name Yogacara. There was some ring about that, maybe yoga, kind of ringed with me. But then when I started to read it, I realized how compatible it was to kind of my own personal practice. Because in my own personal practice, those of you that study with me, I'm a little more eclectic than most Zen teachers. I have a deep affinity for the study of these dharmas that is more emphasized in the Theravadan tradition, the Vipassana tradition. Zen, as it moved up into China, tended to take more of a holistic, big picture and had a much more of an emphasis about don't get hung up on these dharmas. So for me, it's always been trying to, well, don't get hung up on them, but don't forget them. And so Yogacara, for me, does a great job of integration. It takes the old school, the old way of looking at meditation in, which I'll talk a little bit more. But one thing about the Yogacara is, what it means is, yoga means, Yogacara means application of yoga. Application of yoga. And what is the definition of yoga? Maybe you've wondered that. Yoga means seeking union with the divine. It actually predates Buddhism. Yoga, seeking union with the divine. And so what Yogacara does, it's, quote, the school that teaches knowing. It's the school that teaches knowing how to have union with the divine, which is kind of what we're doing, aren't we? Isn't that kind of what we're doing? Whatever our own definition of what, you know, what the divine is. And so the Yogacara takes the old school, takes the new emphasis, which is emphasized more in the Heart Sutra, and kind of brings them together. As often happens when I'm kind of thinking about a Dharma talk, a koan was presented to me, and this was by Shito, was the teacher and a student, and I've mentioned this in a couple of Dharma talks. The student goes, how does one become emancipated? That's the question we're always asking, right? How do we alleviate our suffering? How do we get emancipated? How do we get liberated? How can I be more free? And Shito says his answer is, who binds you? Who binds you? Who binds you? You could ask the question, what binds you? I would say the old school in the study of these dharmas, of the wholesome dharmas and unwholesome dharmas, it was more like, what binded you? What was that state of mind that bound you? But Shito takes it a little deeper, more in alignment, I think, with the Heart Sutra, which is, who is it? Who's this fabrication, this who that you think you're trying to protect. Who is this? Look at who. Look deeply into who is. So, the Yogacara was started by the apex was around the 6th century Common Era. It was started, formulated by two brilliant Buddhist theologians that are, when we chant the names of the patriarchs that brought the Dharma on the male side of the lineage, Bashabandhu is actually cited in there, right along with Dogen and Buddha and the seven Buddhas before Buddha. Bashabandhu is actually there because his thinking was so seminal. And what he was, is he was one of the experts in the 6th century on the Abhidharma, the study of these dharmas. Began to see, as the Heart Sutra did, that there's a limitation to it, that even the study of the dharmas are empty, that they're interrelated. You can't isolate them, which is what the Heart Sutra is saying. So he started the Yogacara school, and what the Yogacara school is also called, which I always was very attracted to, is called the mind-only school. So now just, if you can just try out this very radical proposition, is that things exist only as processes of knowing, not as objects. Outside the knowing process, there is no reality. Now, that's a pretty radical statement, right? So, if you can begin to believe that a little bit, that in fact, your mind is what is creating the universe. That's what the Yogacara. If you really believe that and really operate from that assumption, you are constantly creating whatever that you is, which is also not a solid thing, is creating the universe. So once you begin to understand this, the rest of the teachings that come to you in the Mahayana tradition start to make a lot more sense. All the teachings that are suddenly telling you, oh, you're not really a solid self. Or in the Lojan teachings where it says, see everything as a dream. Don't see it so solid. See everything as a dream. More ephemeral, more a flow rather than something solid. That begins to make a little more sense to you. Or the Diamond Sutra that says, it's like a flash of lightning, it's like a bubble in a stream. Emphasizing more the ephemeral quality of things, so you don't have to stick to them, kind of erodes your sense of attachment. And for some reason, 15 years ago, I was reading a quote by Trungpa. And Trungpa was talking to another Tibetan Lama, and his statement was, this is a little dualistic, but he says, they think that is a tree. And I thought, what does that mean? That they think, me, right? Or people that don't understand a deeper level of reality think that's a tree. I think what Trungpa was saying to this other Rinpoche is that that tree, that outside phenomenal Dharma reality, is actually a fabrication of your mind. That as this eye makes contact with the tree, certain perceptions arise, and conditioning formulates what you think the tree is. Without that process, there is no tree. So let's just hold that for a minute and we'll go a little bit deeper. So, how does this affect our meditation practice? So, again, in the old school, there were like conditioned dharmas and unconditioned dharmas. I mean, there are wholesome dharmas and unwholesome dharmas. You know, and some of the unwholesome dharmas were like attachment, aversion, ignorance, the big three. Also, things like envy, pretension, concealment, conceit, mental fogginess, carelessness, distraction. These are just a few of a list of 30 or 40 what they call unwholesome dharmas. And the wholesome dharmas were more liberated. Love, compassion, sympathetic joy. Those are states of mind. So the practice was to move from the unwholesome to the wholesome dharmas. The other was there were conditioned dharmas. All the dharmas are conditioned, and you were trying to get to what we call unconditioned dharmas. That was like nirvana, peace, spaciousness. Only a few unconditioned dharmas. So you're trying to go from conditioned to unconditioned. You're trying to go from unwholesome to wholesome. But the problem with that was that it got you to a state of mind of where this is not, I don't like this, and I'm going to like that better. This isn't good, that's better. And there was something about that dualistic way of looking at meditation which was in there. So you can feel that, right? You feel it in your own, like, I don't like the way I am right now. You know, I've got to change. I've got to be enlightened. I've got to change myself. They saw that there was some real problem in terms of accepting reality the way it was in this moment. So the new form of meditation, encouraged by the Heart Sutra, what it's saying is the flow. More go with the flow. Lighten up. Accept your state of mind the way it is. Don't see it as so dualistic of needing to get to some other place. That right now, as your mind is, there is liberation in that immediate reality. Or as we say in the Fukan Zazengi, think beyond thinking. Think beyond, think bigger, is what that's saying. Think bigger than what you happen to be thinking. Or you could say that in the moment, it isn't like you've got to work real hard to get rid of these unwholesome dharmas, greed, hate, delusion. Got to get rid of them. Then I'll be okay. It was more like you can liberate them in the moment. You can self-liberate them in the moment, which you all will experience today. Just notice when your mind contracts around the pain in your leg or some thought about somebody did something. Notice as you drop the thought or let the thought abate, notice that you're self-liberating that particular dharma. That's what you're doing, right? We just have this fancy word. The other way to think about it is the identification with a dharma. Suppose you're in the big dharma of anger or irritation, and you're identified behind it. I'm in this unwholesome dharma, angry dharma. I need to liberate and get out of it. No, you begin to see that anger, there's some... it's okay. There's some okayness about that state of mind. It's also a much more joyful way to practice, right? Because you don't have to go around thinking, I got to purify myself. Everything that happens is just an opportunity to liberate. You can kind of, it may look the same on the outside. People are trying really hard on their cushion. But the state of mind is very different in terms of how you look at it. Okay, now I'm going to shift a little bit. So I was a Zen priest for a number of years before I went back to school. You know, I got ordained in 78. I didn't go back to school to 90 to become a psychotherapist. Why would I do that? I did that because I realized that some of these, what we call dharmas, Western psychology doesn't call them dharmas, and he just calls them states of mind that are not, you know, aren't very helpful. It causes a lot of suffering. And what I noticed is that some of these states of mind were particularly pernicious. And that if I just sat without having a background of meditation, that you needed something more. You needed to be able to work with these states of mind because they were so pernicious. It wasn't just so simple as self-liberating them. And a lot of my fellow ordained priests felt the same way and went back to psychotherapy and tried to see it in a Western context, usually a transpersonal context. And what we found was that we both needed to work with them specifically, these states of mind, and we needed meditation practice to help a bigger perspective of how to liberate them in the moment. Both. So that's one reason I like the Yogacara, because the Yogacara actually honors that. system and honors both the old school, working with the unwholesome dharmas, but it also honors the emptiness of the dharmas. So our states of mind are important to us. We need to pay attention to what our states of mind are. And we need sometimes to work very specifically with how to apply the appropriate antidote. And we can sit on our cushion and we can self-liberate. So, again, the main tenet of, I think, Yogacara, again, is that the outside, we are creating the outside world. So this is a tremendous antidote to Western, the way we think about things. Usually, we put a lot of emphasis in our culture and our training and our school in the material world. How we can control it, how we can manipulate it, you know, how we can possess it. It's out there, and we can figure out a way to work with it, right? We do this all the time. What Zen practice tends to do, and what Yogacara practice tends to do, is to blur that distinction between inside and outside. If the outside is actually a product of our mind, we begin to relate to it very differently. So maybe there are three ways. So all these are included. Everything I'm going to say right now, you already know. And you've already heard it as I've talked, and Chris has talked about the Heart Sutra. But maybe the Yogacara tends to break things down. It takes this concept of what we call emptiness, or I like the term maybe better, cause Ta-Nehisi's translation, boundlessness, everything is just included in one big package, boundlessness. Emptiness, for some people, tends to be a little cool, you know, rather excluding, it's actually including everything. So these three ways to look at it are just different ways to approach emptiness. One way in the Yogacara is they talk about the imagined nature, the interdependent nature, and the perfected nature, all of which are included. So the imagined nature, Chris, what time do we, does this end? At 10:50?
10:40.
10:40, okay. So the imagined nature means that we have this capacity, the self, particularly the self, but everything is basically a perceptual and conceptual experience of feeling and ideas. That's what puts us together, these aggregates in the Heart Sutra, form, feeling, perceptions, impulses, consciousness. We put them together and we formulate this imagined image of a self. And that we're sort of hardwired to do this. And we get very attached to this image of ourselves, of Bruce as a priest or good guy or whatever those images are. We get very attached to them and we solidify them. And in fact, we're sort of, neuroscience tells us that we're sort of hardwired because that's how we survived, right? I mean, I'm out there, there's lions outside my cave, I have to protect myself or my genes don't get passed on. So there's a reason why we're kind of solidified into this sense. But the reality is, the downside is it creates a tremendous sense of self-concern and self-protection. And that's, of course, what the Dharma tries to alleviate. It sees that the suffering in the world is so much about trying to protect ourselves. And so what we do, because we solidify ourselves and we solidify others, we make other things and people bad. And we also objectify and make ourselves bad because we have these set ideas. So we have a lot of self-criticism for ourselves. We have a lot of self-criticism for others. Somebody told me something the other day that was very profound. He was reading a book on Miwok Indian basket making. And he said, and he somehow found the statistic, that 70% of our words, quite not his word, are nouns, and only 30% are verbs. So that's extremely profound, because it means that we say Bruce, you know, or Dale, or Bob, right? Or Patty. We're that tree, right? River, water. It's a noun. But other cultures, it's more verbs. In the Indian language, it's more verbs. Everything is a process. Nothing, it's not a, like, I'm not Bruce. I'm just a flow of form, feeling, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness, which is what, exactly what the Heart Sutra tells you in the first line. And all these are related together. So that's what we mean when we say the imagined nature. We think things, we imagine things to be. And we do this all the time. This is what our views do. This is what our concepts do. And that's why the heart of the Heart Sutra is the underpinning is any idea that you have about anything is limited because it's a verb and not a noun. Do you get that? If you say it's a noun, it's like, well, that's the way it is. But a verb is like, oh, it's just changing moment by moment by moment. Oh, what's next? What's next? What's next, beginner's mind? So that's very important. So that's the first. The first is that imagined nature. And we see it all the time. For example, one example, a classic example is we see a rope and we think it's a snake, right? We think somebody does something and we think they don't like us, when in fact they've just been sick and they didn't get our email, right? That's why they didn't respond. We're constantly looking at things in a much more limited perspective. The other thing that I liked about the Yogacara is they have a word that I've always loved. It's called the Alaya Vijnana. And when we were early days at Zen Center, we had a stitchery, a closed stitchery, and it was called the Alaya Stitchery. I don't know who came up with that, but I liked it. You stitch things together, which is what sutra means, actually. When you sew a raksu or a robe, you're stitching. Or a sutra is you stitch things together, putting things together, bigger, small things into bigger things, which is another definition of kind of what boundlessness or emptiness is. And Alaya Vijnana is actually means your store consciousness. So back in the 5th century, they had a very deep understanding of the subconscious or the unconscious mind. That the way you create reality is basically by these synaptic connections, you know, by neurotransmitters making these connections with the eye and the outside object. And then your Alaya Vijnana surfaces your unconscious, and which creates your conditioned response and your perceptual response. That's actually what's happening. It's all happening in your mind. So the idea, again, being is that you begin to understand or believe in that process more than the external reality that I'm a noun, you're a noun, and we have to relate to each other sort of on that level. So the next level is the interdependent level, which is more like emptiness. So you have it imagined. You think things are imagined. The next thing is the idea of emptiness, that everything, instead of separate, is actually totally bound up, that anything you say about anything does not stand alone. And the great example that I was reviewing last night is Thich Nhat Hanh, where we have a rose, which is extraordinarily beautiful. Thank you, Chris, for putting the rose up there. And then we have a compost bucket, which if you leave for a week on the counter, looks a lot like shit, and actually begins to smell a little bit like it. Yucky. Beautiful. But the compost turns into the rose in a couple of months. That's the idea, is that you can't have bad without good. That when you begin to polarize, you begin to see that everything happens because of something else. This is because that is. This is because that is. People commit crimes because society is structured in a certain way, or the way they were raised. This is because that is. What you think is bad is actually intertwined with everything else. So we become much less judgmental in terms of how we polarize, we look at things. And the third, so imagine nature, interdependent nature, and the third is the most difficult. The third is what he calls the perfected nature. And the perfected nature means, and this is the hardest for us, is everything as perfect as it is. So when Suzuki Roshi says you are perfect exactly as you are, and you could use a little work, that to me is a great summation of Yogacara. Because you're perfect just as you are means that reality is reality. It is exactly as it is. It just is. And you may not want it to be that way. There may be suffering involved in it, but those suffering is an add-on. So we have a tremendous ability, what we call self-referential add-ons, right? Is that we're always adding on our opinion and our conditioned responses, which comes up from the Alaya Vijnana. So if we could just hang out more in what we call just pure clarity, just as the Buddha originally said, just in the eye of the perception, you know, or the hearing, the sound, and we don't do the self-referential add-ons. So that's what our practice is about, really. And in the Yogacara, they give you a couple, which I think is very helpful, points. One is, when you're sitting, notice your state of mind. That's important. That's the part where Suzuki Roshi says you could use a little work. Notice your state of mind. Notice that you're stuck in irritation, contraction. You have to notice that. The second is accept it. Accept that your mind is what's creating that state of mind. That's the hard one. Instead of thinking the outside world is creating it, it is your mind that is creating that state of mind. And then the third, which is quite beautiful, is that you need your meditation practice because you need to calm your mind and body down. You need to calm your body down and your mind, because when your mind is activated through these thoughts, these dharmas, we call them unwholesome dharmas or whatever, you know, cortisol is surging through your system, you're contracted and you don't have any clarity. You don't have any clarity on how to get out of this. So you have to notice it, you have to own it, and then you have to calm the body-mind so insight can arise. You can begin to see and actually feel the self-liberating quality of your mind, but you can't do that unless the mind is calmed down enough. That's why we sit. That's why sitting is so important. You can do it cognitively, like in cognitive therapy, but it's limited. If you can join the awareness with the calmness, that's where liberation can happen.